Well, thank you for the invitation. It's really good to be here and to share the session with Jill. You will see that we are broadly interested in similar issues, responsibility, control, and capacity, although we are going to be looking at and focusing on quite different cases. So today I'm quite interested in the role that certain symptoms of schizophrenia, in particular psychotic symptoms such as hallucinations and delusions, play in our understanding of whether someone is responsible for the actions that may be motivated by such symptoms, and whether someone can be considered to be epistemically responsible for having delusions in the first place. So those are the two questions. So one general question is, how should a psychiatric diagnosis affect our judgment about moral and legal responsibility for criminal action? This is a debate that we encounter all the time with very high profile cases, and I think it shows that there are some inconsistencies in the public perception of whether someone is responsible for criminal action when this person has a psychiatric diagnosis attached to them. We should look at two cases in which people with delusions commit crimes and think about the factors that are relevant to whether they are actually responsible for the crimes that they commit in the light of the fact that they are at least motivated or partially driven by the delusion. So one aspect of it is really the transition from belief to action. Can someone be responsible for performing an action that is motivated by a delusional belief? Are actions driven by such beliefs somehow inescapable, given those beliefs? And does the presence of delusional beliefs imply some underlying problem with decision making, which I think is an assumption that we often make, but it, at the moment, is not really substantiated by empirical evidence? The other aspect is really from the experience to the belief. I won't say very much about this. But can someone be responsible for adopting or maintaining a delusional belief? Of course, there is a big question in philosophy whether someone should be responsible for a belief in general. But I will try to say something about how to interpret this question in a way that is not too controversial. And then the idea is whether someone should be responsible for maintaining or adopting a belief that for which that person doesn't have sufficient evidence. So I want to start with a case study. It's a bit old now, but it's something that I wrote up with Matthew Broom and Matteo Mameli. Matthew Broom is a clinical and academic psychiatrist, and this was one of his clinical cases. And it's a very simple case, but I think it highlights some of the complexities of attributions of responsibility in the case where we've got a diagnosis of schizophrenia. So Bill was a young man who had been admitted to a psychiatric unit because he himself contacted the police saying that he wasn't well, there was some problem with him. He was worried that he was acting in a weird way and that he might test his invincibility. He had this belief that he was invincible, he could not die, by jumping off the balcony of his apartment. Now, he seemed to have, it was the primary symptom, auditory hallucinations. He reported that people he could not see were talking to him, so we would say he was hearing voices, that his upstairs neighbor had been banging and shouting, and that thoughts were being taken out of his head. So they're quite typical symptoms of schizophrenia, and that's the diagnosis that was attached to him. He was he spent 6 weeks in hospital, then he felt much better, was taking medication, he was discharged from hospital. And initially, after his discharge, he cooperated with his medical team and with the community mental health team. But he did refuse to participate in rehabilitation activity, and after a while, he was no longer compliant with medication. This meant that his symptoms came back, in particular the auditory hallucinations that had been troubling him before. So Bill claimed to have no symptoms, but he reported feeling low at the beginning and complained that his neighbor was making a lot of noise, keeping him awake at night. One day, so the door opened in the neighbor's flat. He went in and removed a set of keys, an axe, and a hammer. One night, Bill heard again banging noises and shouting coming from the neighbor's flat. That was something that, according to him, was a fairly general occurrence. But this time he got really angry and decided to take action. He went upstairs, he entered the flat with the intention to confront the neighbor, that's what he said, just verbally. But he lost his temper and ended up seriously injuring the neighbor, who was taken to hospital with multiple fractures. Now, how should we think about this case? When Bill was interviewed a couple of months after the offense took place, and the offense was burglary and grievous bodily harm with intent, he admitted to have stopped taking medication after the first weeks of discharge, and that he had started hearing and banging, hearing the banging and shouting from the neighbor's flat, although he didn't say anything about those being hallucinations. He thought they were true experiences. He said he had removed axe and hammer because he didn't want them to be used against him, so it was a kind of self-protection, self-defense. And he had taken the keys in case he needed to access the flat at a later stage. So he did admit that he had an intention, so he knew what he was doing when he was removing these objects, because he thought he might actually use the keys to enter the flat. But in the account that he offers, that was to protect himself from what he perceived to be a very aggressive and potentially violent neighbor. Now, Bill was found fit to plead. At the time of his assessment, he understood the indictment, was capable of following the evidence submitted in his case, could instruct his legal team, could follow the court proceedings, and he could understand the role of the jurors and the witnesses. When he's assessed, he is found able to form specific intentions, and also he was found aware that his actions may lead to violence and harm. But at the time of the assessment, he denied any plans to harm the neighbor and actually was surprised, or declared to be surprised, at how the events had escalated. He realized that his action had been wrong and unlawful. The opinion of his clinical team was at the time of the offense, he had relapsed, basically. He was having these psychotic symptoms that initially medication had been quite helpful in getting rid of. He was reporting a recurrence of what we think are hallucinatory auditory experiences, and as part of this, the banging and the shouting from the flat above him. So what was the sentence? In the end, Bill was found guilty, was sentenced to 2 years probation and a suspended custodial sentence. And because of this diagnosis of schizophrenia, the sentence was significantly less than otherwise would be expected. So he didn't spend time in prison at all. Now, how should we understand this case? So is it legitimate that his diagnosis of schizophrenia, and in particular the presence of the psychotic symptoms that he was having, should lead to an attribution of responsibility that is different from the attribution of responsibility that we would be happy with if he hadn't had such a diagnosis or such symptoms. So the fact that Bill experienced hallucination is clearly plays a part clearly in what his actions were. So it seems as if the reason why he attacked his neighbor was that he was convinced that the neighbor was a threatening presence in his life. And if he hadn't, this is just speculation, but probably if he hadn't had these kind of hallucinations and he hadn't linked them to the neighbor, he wouldn't have been that aggressive towards the neighbor. So that is the first initial claim. The presence of the hallucination of the experience, as it was, makes it easier for us to understand why Bill acted in the way he did. At the same time, I don't think he excuses or justifies what he did, because of course you can think that your neighbor is shouting, and you can think of lots of different ways in which you can try and stop him. You can think about going to talk to him, you can think about calling the police if the thing becomes quite serious. And sort of there are lots of courses of action that are open to you if you have this experience, even if this experience is veridical. So it, the the presence of the symptoms seems to be very helpful in trying to explain what has happened. They don't necessarily excuse or justify the level of aggression that Bill manifested. So there are several options that were open to him. Now, a question that Matthew raised when we were thinking about this case is the possible presence of delusions, which are these kind of quite implausible and beliefs that are resistant to evidence and are a positive symptom of schizophrenia. Now, it's very likely that together with the hallucinations, Bill also had a set of delusional beliefs about his neighbors. For instance, that he did mean him harm, some kind of persecution, and that he might have tried to harm him in the future. Now, if these were also present, and possibly some other delusions that are quite common in this context, for instance, that the neighbor might not have been amenable to reason, or that the police would have not believed Bill, given his past history of mental illness, might go a little bit further in explaining why he decided to take matters in his own hand and confront the neighbor without choosing an alternative solution. So what if Bill's hallucinatory experiences and probable delusional beliefs had just been the tip of the iceberg? So this is the next step. So the symptoms may help us explain, they do not justify and excuse, but what if they are a sign that something else is going wrong? So what if actually Bill's decision-making capacities are more generally impaired and the presence of these hallucinations and delusions are just one way in which this impairment is manifested? In this case, it is possible that his ability to act in morally and legally acceptable ways might have been compromised. But at the moment, there isn't a lot of evidence suggesting that the general way in which the decision-making apparatus works is related to the presence of these symptoms that would make us suppose that there is a very strong link between having psychotic symptoms and being unable to making decisions in the moral context. But certainly that's a question mark, and it's something open, I think, for empirical work to be done. If the evidence of malfunctioning decision-making had been available, attributing to Bill less than full responsibility would have been entirely legitimate. But in the real-life case, it's not clear whether the presence of the psychotic symptoms were actually evidence of further impairments. As it happens, Bill did commit crime again. This time he committed homicide. That's just something that is not in the original paper because it happened after we wrote it, but it's kind of interesting that there is a follow-up. A much more high-profile case is the Breivik case, which is the mass murder in Norway, who killed 77 people in what he defined as an attempt to stop the Islamization of Norway. Now, what is really interesting about this case is that a lot of the controversy about whether Breivik should have been regarded as responsible for what he did relied on the specific diagnosis that the psychiatric teams assessing him made. And there was a real polarization there about what the right interpretation of his behavior should have been. In his first psychiatric evaluation, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and his most implausible beliefs were considered to be bizarre delusions. So that was clearly a psychotic symptom. If psychotic, Breivik could have not been accountable for his action according to the Norwegian Criminal Procedure Code, because if one has psychotic symptoms, it doesn't depend on the diagnosis of schizophrenia, but the presence of psychotic symptoms, according to that code, you cannot be criminally responsible. So you'd have been regarded as criminally insane and sentenced to compulsory psychiatric treatment. That is what initially happened, because this was the first official psychiatric assessment of Breivik. Of course, this generated quite a lot of uproar. Politically and in public perception, people were just not happy that Breivik could not be locked up properly for what he did. And a second psychiatric assessment was organized, was arranged, and this time he got away with a different psychiatric diagnosis, narcissistic personality disorder accompanied by pathological lying. According to this diagnosis, mental capacity is intact, and so Breivik was held accountable for his action and he was sentenced to 21 years in prison, which is the maximum sentence in Norway. As it happens, Breivik did insist on being reassessed himself because he didn't want to be regarded as mentally insane, criminally insane. Now, apart from the political pressures that might explain why a second assessment was arranged, I think what is really interesting is that there was substantial disagreement among the experts about whether the beliefs that Breivik had were delusional or not. Some argued that they were not delusional, and this is the second assessment, because actually many extremist groups kind of share the same beliefs that Breivik was reporting and writing about when he wanted to stop the multicultural nature of the society in which he was living. But another opinion was that actually the second assessment had taken place many months after the offense. Breivik had changed. He was no longer in the acute phase of schizophrenia, if we believe that that's what he had all along. Plus, in favor of the first psychiatric assessment, some of the beliefs that Breivik reported were not shared by extremist group, were very idiosyncratic to himself. For instance, he thought he was the new king of Norway. He thought he could decide who was to live and to die in the nation, just like that. And these seem to be beliefs that suggest psychosis. They're not just wrong or prejudice. They seem to be beliefs that are not in the range of beliefs that we have independent of our political conviction. So what is really interesting for me in this case is that changing the diagnosis, so the behavior is the same, but changing the diagnosis, you get two completely different outcomes. In the first one, you get the most severe sentence you can get, 21 years in prisons. In the other one, you just get, it's still not very nice, but still compulsory treatment in a psychiatric institution. So is it right that so much hang on whether Breivik's beliefs were delusional or not? Now, I'm a bit simplifying, but really, I think that was one of the key questions on which this decision relied on. And it seems to me that independent of whether those beliefs were delusional or not, they had very similar features. They were not supported by evidence. They could lead to very dangerous and harmful action. And in this particular case, they motivated criminal action. They help us, as in the case of Bill, explain why Breivik behaved in the way he did, even just a little bit, get a little bit clearer about what might have gone on there. So why should the attribution of responsibility to Breivik depend on his psychiatric diagnosis, schizophrenia versus personality disorders? It seems all to be down to whether the beliefs are delusional, and that does not seem quite right. It seems as if too much is hanging on the particular diagnosis that the psychiatric team is making. So as we saw with Bill, unless the presence of delusions also signals the presence of a deficit or impairment that impacts on the decision to commit the crime, there seems to be no principal reasons to deny responsibility to Breivik only if he's found to be delusional. So what is, seems really weird is that the political pressure should change the psychiatric assessment. If we want a certain outcome to be the case, you know, why should we kind of pressurize psychiatrists in this way? That seems quite a strange situation to be in. So some preliminary conclusions, the presence of hallucinations or delusions alone, I think, should not have default implications for responsibility. Of course, they have implications, but they shouldn't just determine what our attitude towards the attribution of responsibility is. It does raise concern that people have the psychiatric symptoms, either because these symptoms are a source of inaccurate information on the basis of which people act, or because they may signal impairments or deficits in decision-making itself. which suggests a much more strong link between the presence of delusions and hallucinations and lack of responsibility. Very briefly, I want to point to another interesting question, which is, okay, maybe we're not responsible for what we do if we are motivated by delusional beliefs, but are we responsible for getting these delusional beliefs in the first place? And that is something that I'm working on as part of my current project, and I've given you some information about the project if you're interested in following that up. What I'm really looking at the possible implications, positive and negative, of cognitions that are inaccurate or unjustified. Now, the ethics of belief is a really interesting field, which I've approached only recently, so I still have enormous gaps in my knowledge of it. But I think Clifford adds this idea that we should really be responsible for our beliefs, in the sense that if we form a belief on the basis of insufficient evidence, and we have the means to get more evidence or better evidence for it, then we may be in a position to be blamed for having that particular belief. And based on the fact that delusions present significant epistemic faults, I mentioned before, they are not supported by sufficient evidence, they are quite implausible given the other things that we know, they are very resistant to counter-evidence, we might think that actually agents who adopt delusions may be responsible for failing to fulfill their epistemic obligations, if we think there is anything like that. But I want to give you two reasons to resist this way of thinking. So although I think that the presence of delusions itself doesn't excuse us from behavior that is driven by those delusions, I actually think that having the delusions is not something that we are necessarily responsible for. So the first consideration is that although delusions have a lot of epistemic faults, as the ones I've briefly described to you, they may actually have a positive epistemic role in certain specific contexts. In the sense that when you consider where the agent is coming from, what their experiences are, what their emotional and affective states are, the presence of delusion sometimes is actually momentarily and all things considered beneficial. It's a very counterintuitive claim, and so don't take my word for it, but one case where this argument has been made, and is by no means the only case, is the reverse Othello syndrome. So you know about the Othello syndrome is like delusion of jealousy, right? So you think your partner, your romantic partner, is being unfaithful when that's not the case. Now, the reverse Othello syndrome is the opposite. You think your partner is being faithful to you when they are not. And this is what happened to a young, very talented musician who became quadriplegic as a result of a car accident. His long-term partner left him, but while he was in hospital doing rehabilitation, he formed the belief that his partner actually was still with him, and actually they just married. Now, his previous girlfriend didn't want to have anything to do with him, but this belief was very obstinate. He wouldn't give it up. No other delusions or psychotic symptoms were observed in the musician, and the delusion was interpreted by his clinical team as a psychological defense against depression. He was just trying to come to terms with the fact that his life wouldn't have been the same due to his disability, and losing the idea that he had someone close to him who still wanted to be with him might have further impaired his capacity to cope with the situation and engage in the rehabilitation. So here delusion is interpreted as an emergency response. It's not always beneficial, of course. It's just that at the time, it plays a critical role in allowing the person to develop a way of engaging with the world around him or her, him in this case, that would not be possible otherwise. So although negative emotions, stress and anxiety are very natural and often adaptive responses to traumatic and threatening situations, when they become overwhelming, they are correlated with difficulties in directed thinking and recall. They cause irritability and emotional disturbances. Stress and negative emotions have been linked to poor short-term memory, impaired concentration, and reduced attention. Such difficulties have a negative impact on agents' capacity to acquire new information and to just engage in the normal epistemic exchanges that we all have with each other. So in this sense, we can think of delusions as a way of relieving the stress, when the delusion is, as a content, something that is better than the truth for the person involved. And it may be better in some circumstances than the paralyzing state of depression that is likely to take over otherwise. Of course, this applies only to the very initial stage, where these emotions and stress need to be managed. Of course, when the delusion continues on, it becomes very stressful itself, a cause of anxiety itself, and harmful in many more ways. But as a fact, the case described by Butler of this musician tells us that after a while the delusion just disappeared, and he came to accept that his relationship had ended. So he played that function. And of course, not all delusions are like that, but we can find positive epistemic roles in a different variety of delusions. The other reason why I don't think we should hold people responsible for holding delusional beliefs is kind of more, comes from more deontological considerations, is that it's not clear that they have the ability to believe otherwise. So when people form delusions, very often they are vulnerable to biases or impairments or motivational factors that compromise their capacity to form a different belief about the situation that is not delusional. So what does it mean lacking the ability to believe otherwise? Someone can believe otherwise if there is an evidential action which is available to them, so that if they had performed it, they would have believed otherwise. And what are evidential actions? An evidential action is directly related to searching, gathering, or processing evidence. So there are things that you can do to acquire a different belief, and those are within your capacity. Now, the argument is that assuming that an agent has a delusional belief that P, the agent is not blameworthy for her belief if she believes that P partly because she was not able to believe otherwise, and she's not responsible for the fact that she was not able to believe otherwise. Now, what's the evidence that suggests that people are not really able to perform the right evidential actions and believe otherwise in the situation? Many people with delusions seem to have their ability to believe otherwise at least compromised by a series of things. So in the context of schizophrenia, this could be anomalous experience. We saw Bill and the hallucination. The presence of hallucination might be quite difficult to explain if you don't do it via a belief that then turns out to be delusional, but also impairments and biases that are more common, more like on a continuum with normal range biases that we all have. So people with delusions do not regard alternative hypotheses as life possibilities. This has been found by Freeman in people in an acute stage of psychosis, but it's quite likely that this might apply to people prior to adopting the delusional belief. So the live options, believing that it's not my neighbor, but it's my mind playing tricks with me, might not be available to the person who then forms the delusion that the neighbor wants to harm them. The other thing is jumping to conclusions before examining the available evidence. So it's quite common for people who are prone to delusional thinking to come to a conclusion without sufficient evidence. And also the adoption of the delusion may be affected by motivational factors. And you've had an example of this in the Butler's case of reverse Othello syndrome, the fact that BX really desired for his partner to still be with him affected the way in which he was thinking about his relationship. So of course there are exceptions we might consider to whether someone is responsible for not being able to believe otherwise, and two cases that come to mind could be when the delusions are triggered by drug use, or if the person is aware that he is prone to delusional thinking but still doesn't comply with medication, as one could argue was the case with Bill, who had stopped complying with medication after his hospital discharge. So just to conclude, we saw that having psychotic symptoms does not rule out by default that people may be responsible for actions driven by their symptoms. unless we can show that the symptoms are also an indication that their decision-making capacities are compromised. And we saw that although delusions are epistemically faulty, no two ways about it, they may have some epistemic value in some context. So it might not be always bad to adopt a delusion, at least temporarily in a case of acute distress in a at a critical time. And people should not be responsible, should not be held responsible for adopting them in a standard situation, as they might be subject to either unusual experiences or reasoning biases or impairments that affect their ability to believe otherwise. Thank you very much.